These days, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries, sending away good jobs and our capability to make things. American Giant is pushing back against that tide. They make the high-quality clothing staples you need for a comfortable, stylish, and active summer wardrobe, like vintage-style tees, breathable polos, lightweight sweatshirts, and so much more, right here in the USA. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs in towns and cities across the country, and jobs bring pride, purpose. They stitch people together. Support America's workers and get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code STAPLE20.
Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/prenatal.
Welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. I'm here with my good friend, Mark. My name is Michael Walker. How are you today?
I'm very well, Walker. How are you?
Good. This whole week was very exciting, very restful. About, you know, after recording last week's episode, I had, you know, had to rethink about how I introduced games to people, and that long period of time between episodes was very useful.
You know, and sometimes it's strange. During those periods of intense reflection and introspection, sometimes it feels like an entire week can pass by in just a few minutes. It's very true. Strange how that works.
Very strange.
For more reflections on the nature of time, check out my Patreon-exclusive episode on metaphysics and all the people it put into a sleeping stupor.
So, like we said, a podcast about board games. We're going to talk about the game we reviewed exactly 1 year ago. And then on this episode, we are then going to talk about all of the games that we played this week, which was plenty due to reasons.
So many games.
And then we're going to close it off with a very, very brief news segment. And here we go. The Eurus, the yet unnamed retrospective.
You almost got there. It's the as-yet-unnamed retrospective intro segment.
And exactly 1 year ago, we reviewed a game called Flamecraft. And I haven't thought about it since.
Not a moment since. Yeah, I remember it being overlong, not particularly satisfying, but very, very cutesy. It's one of the... Look, there are many reasons why games can be flashes in the pan in this hobby of ours. And that's not even necessarily a bad thing. You know, it's the same thing with movies. Like, oh, a movie comes out. Oh, that was kind of pleasant. I'll never think about it again. Okay, fine, whatever. We talked a lot about that a few weeks ago. But one of the ways that a game can be a flash in the pan is it's just really cutesy and really kind of charming. And a whole bunch of people will fawn over how cute it is. And the moment it leaves your field of vision, you forget about it instantaneously. And I think that's a pretty good description of Flamecraft.
Yes, it is very much a bone standard recipe fulfillment game.
Absolutely.
You collect goods and then you spend those goods to fulfill a recipe, and then you get some more goods.
To fulfill another recipe?
Just so. And that's Flamecraft.
Whee! I haven't even seen it played since. I think one person a few months ago asked if people wanted to play it, and I don't think they got enough uptick. Anyway, designed by Manny Vega and published by Cardboard Alchemy, Flamecraft.
All right, now up is the games we played last week.
Get ready.
Just
brace
week,
yourself.
Just 1 week ago, though.
It's true.
Not 2 weeks ago.
No, definitely not. That would be a lie, and we would never lie about that. We're not time travelers,
exactly.
Walker.
So I got Dune Imperium Uprising onto the table again. Once again, it was for someone that requested it. Dune Imperium Uprising is a deck-building game that is combined with worker placement. And both of those things are completely unexciting. It's very boring cards paired with very basic worker placement. but I find it very inoffensive. Just for that, you take your turns. It's very quick. You're sort of hinting that you're going to fight. You know, you might play a bunch of cards that, you know, get you into battle. You're sort of assessing the combat card of that round, because every round there's a new combat card. They put in this new mechanism where there are symbols on the cards now, and every time you have two combat cards of the same symbol, you can cash those in for yet another victory point. So I like some of the things they've done. There's these new spies that are out now that you can, you know, trade out for drawing more cards or for going to spaces where other people are. And drawing cards really seems to be just the quintessential way to play, because it gets you more money at the end of the turn to buy more cards, to get better things, to work up to buying like the very expensive cards that you victory points. Anyway, it was a flop from everyone. They did not enjoy it.
Mm.
The worms just seem too powerful in most cases, because they give you a huge combat boost. And not only that, if you have a worm in combat, you get the reward twice.
Ah.
Yeah. So double down on not only are they powerful, but they also give you bonus rewards. So I'm sure everyone will disagree with what I say, because Dune Imperium Uprising is very popular.
It is.
Like I said, I still have it. I still suggest it. I still play it just because I enjoy Dune. And I enjoy how quickly this particular game moves around. And for what it does in its time, I think it does an okay job.
I have yet to see, I've yet to play the Uprising version of Dune Imperium, but I've yet to see worker placement and deck building combined in an interesting way, which is weird because we've seen deck building combined with a whole bunch of other stuff in a lot of interesting. Have it power a race game, have it power an area controlled game, have it power an area majority game, have it like...
Well, Bitoku does it in a very, you know, light way.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot. Right. Bitoku, I think, is perhaps the closest to doing it in a more satisfying way. But honestly, it's not much with the deck building.
No.
But people are going to keep trying. Like Lost Ruins of Arnok, I found very bland. And the first version of Dune Imperium, I agree. I mean, I think part of it might be by themselves, deck building can be bland. And worker placement can easily be bland, and so unless you've done a good job to overcome any of those blandnesses, combining them together isn't necessarily going to lead to anything spectacular. I don't know, but that's just speculation. I'm not a game designer. I just rag on those that...
Just so. That is Dune Imperium Uprising, published by Direwolf, designed by Paul Drennan.
Played Anunnaki Dawn of the Gods again. This is by Simone Luciani and Danilo Sabia, published by Cranio Creations last year. And this is a kind of mythologically themed 4X-ish adjacent thing, driven by an emphasis on lots of different pantheons from different mythologies coming together, which is something I'm susceptible to, as well as a clever action selection mechanism, which is also something I'm susceptible to. Effectively, you have this action pawn, and it's going to move to an adjacent action space on your turn, and any path that you cross over gets a little cube. Sometimes dropping a cube gets you a little bit of energy. But the upshot is, the moment you've surrounded a summoning symbol with all of these cubes, with all these paths, you then get to summon either a minor or a major god, giving you points and advancements and special powers. I really like the action selection mechanism. I think it is very clever, and I think it leads to lots of interesting trade-offs, both because you have to weigh the medium and long-term advantages of gods versus the immediate concern about what action you want to take, as well as the secondary concerns about what actions you'd like to take in future turns. The problem is that as an engine to drive a 4X-y adjacent thing, it causes things to move along in fits and starts, and you end up, all your attention ends up focusing on just managing your own personal board and managing your own personal actions. And those other things that sometimes are the highlight of other 4X-y adjacent stuff, like getting new toys, well, all the toys are driven by the action selection mechanism. That's all you're going to get through your gods. And the interaction with other players, it's like, look, my interaction with other players is so far attenuated by the action selection mechanism that I'm not really able to expect them to react to what I'm doing or react to what they're doing. Because just movement actions of troops, for example, my action pawn may be way on the other side. I'm not going to be moving anybody for a long time. And consequently, I felt like I was just engaging in an efficiency puzzle with my own action selection, which is fine, but not really leading to a cohesive or overall engaging game. The other problem I had with Anunnaki Dawn of the Gods was that despite the fact that it puts up so much of your attention on this interesting action selection mechanism, so many of the core elements of the game, like buying weapons, which is a prerequisite for starting a fight, or building new infrastructure in the context of putting out new temples, isn't part of the core action selection mechanism. It's entirely buried in just a list of supplementary actions you do kind of at the end of your turn. And so it ends up feeling very unfocused. And so the big board with all the units moving around and all the plastic pieces representing Egyptian units or Roman units or Babylonian units or what have you, it becomes kind of an afterthought. You're focused on this action selection mechanism, but all the key things you need to do are sometimes buried in this weird menu. It's not that it's confusing. It just feels unfocused.
I just want to interject because I want people to stop typing, because we are both aware that you can spend something to move your pawn somewhere else. But that cost is so great and will put you so far behind that is, I don't think, would be ever worth it.
Right. And it comes at the expense of a lot of other things you desperately do.
Just so.
It just feels unfocused. It feels scattered. It feels like a bunch of stuff that doesn't hang well together. And so I found it perfectly enjoyable enough for playing around with the action selection mechanism, but everything past that felt like a bit of a distraction. And so consequently, I don't feel like it plays to its strengths. I'd play it if someone really wanted to, but honestly, the cool ideas were fun to explore, but I think that this might be a good first draft of something that might evolve into something better. A little bit tighter, better implementation of the action selection mechanism, the overall interaction of the map, or indeed not having a map and having it drive something else. I feel like this is a good driver of something that then doesn't cohere. So that was my further experience with Anunnaki, Dawn of the Gods.
We got to play Raw, designed by Reiner Knizia and put out by Ravensburger Games. And it's just an auction game that is like no other. It is pretty well the top of its genre of auction games. You have three tiles in which you can bid with. You are constantly looking around to see what other bids people have because everyone has different numbers, much like another game but later. And you're drawing tiles out of a bag, which is sort of a push your luck kind of mechanism because the raw tiles are building up. You have to decide whether, you know, you want to grab these lots now while you can, or are those two tiles so important that you really need them?
Raw is amazing. What can I say?
Yeah.
One of the best games ever. Moments of tension, moment of drama, moments of surprise, moments of good calculation. Leveraging the advantage of bad currency tiles because you can't ever make change versus leveraging the advantage of good currency tiles, having the board play and your action selection and what you do with these things, further influencing all of that. Trying to sucker other people to buy lots that you want them to buy when you want them to buy them. It's marvelous.
And not only are you always bidding for the lots, you're looking at the bid that someone won with last turn, because your bid gets exchanged with the one that is out there and then goes face down in front of you. So you might just be wanting to win this bid so you'll get a higher number for next round.
So I have the Uberplay edition of the mid-aughts, which has the same art as the Alia edition from 99, but with bigger and more robust tiles, and still in a very, very small box. I feel, what's a stronger word for pity?
Sadness.
I feel a great sadness for those that don't get to play with the Uberplay edition. The new edition from 25th Century Games is fine. The deluxe edition is, I think, in need of 20% off the top because the box is huge, and we are very much moving away from huge boxes at this stage in our hobby existence.
I think it hurts your eyes when you open the box, too.
I find it a little garish. That's a little, okay, that's a little bit more in terms of personal preference. I actually had someone ask me recently about whether to get the 25th Century Games version or the Dice Tree. Dice Tree is a Korean publisher. I very much like a lot of what they do. They were the ones who published that edition of Leonardo da Vinci Codex Lester that we both liked so much. But the problem is that here in North America, their copies are very, very expensive. And for what it's worth, I think their edition of Raw is also a little garish. Primarily the point tiles are just these bright, shiny gold. And it's kind of. But look, obviously, color palette is a matter of taste. But I like that the Uberplay edition still has the nice chunky wood pieces. It's relatively minimalist. It's got that great Franz Vohwinkel art, which is very much to my taste. And I find the 25th Century Games edition a little bit garish, but it's back in print. And the retail edition is not overdone. Reasonably small box, well-done components. So by all means, this is not meant to discourage anyone from getting or trying the 25th Century Games edition of Raw. Please do. It is absolutely worth it. Try it if you love auction games. Try it if you hate auction games. Try it if you love or hate push your luck games, because this is, I think, the purest distillation of both. It is my favorite auction game and my favorite push your luck game. It's marvelous.
So on the topic of auction games, I played Skyrise. This is a reprint of
Metropolis.
Designed by Gavin Brown, Sebastian Pichon, and Adam Weiss. And this edition is put out by Roxley. And like Raw, you can see everyone's bidding tokens, and they're all different numbers, except there's a whole bunch more. And, well, at least at the beginning of the game, there's a whole bunch more in Skyrise. You have this sprawling map of different colors with different color tokens on each little neighborhood that is in there. And when you start a bid, you put down one of your numbers, which is shaped like a building. And then the next person that wants to outbid you must play it adjacent to that building. And so you're creating this chain through these neighborhoods. And then you have, there's a very interesting decision space, much like Raw, where you decide whether do I want to win to get this token or do I want to win to get that lot. You decide whether you want to win to get that particular token because you're building this little tableau and you're, you know, certain neighborhoods are getting, you know, higher in points. Or do I want to win that actual neighborhood? Because the neighborhoods are also colored in a similar way. And the more you have a certain color of neighborhood, the more points that you're going to generate, as long as you've got those colored tokens as well. You're also getting these lettered tokens, which are mysterious, sort of government people. And they're worth anywhere from like, you know, I think it was 3, 5, 8, whatever.
I will freely admit that bureaucracy is frequently mysterious, but I don't think it's quite as exciting as you're making it sound.
In a way, I found that interesting as well, because when you claim one of those tokens, you get to see what their point value is. So if you flip it up and you see that it's one of the low ones, then you know not to push to try to win more of that letter. So you try to get the other letters in hopes that they're the higher scoring
ones. I see. So it's only blind and unknown for the first time you win it, and then you gradually know how much they're worth and therefore know what you're fighting for.
Just so.
Okay.
And so it's very interesting because there's some points of the map that you can cut off. So if you win a bid, you're the start of the next auction. Whoever wins gets to start the next one. So there's ways you can pinch off the map. So there's only one place. So you win that bid, and now there's sort of a cutoff area. And if you place a token in there, no one can place adjacent to it, so you automatically win that. So there's ways to get rid of your lower tokens. In the first edition, it was all one phase. And so they felt as though there was a problem with people spending all their high buildings at the beginning and then just being locked out for the rest of the game. So they sort of separated your tokens into two phases and put in a scoring. So there's scoring for the first phase, and then you get your new tokens plus any ones that you had left over. And then you start a second phase and go again. I very much enjoyed Skyrise. I'm looking forward to showing it to you because I think you'll enjoy it as well. It led to some weird things at the beginning because it's very much like these games where you don't know
What things are worth. Precisely.
So like the very first auctions, we were creating these like chains that just went forever almost, right? Because it goes from like 1 to 114.
Right.
So, because like, I don't know. You know, yep. People are just going higher and higher and higher and higher. And then eventually it was like, okay, this is ridiculous. And so it was like, bam, 50, right? Anyway, Skyrise by Roxley, a winner.
On the topic of auction games, my segue actually would have been much, much better
Raw.
You completely big leagued me on this.
I did. I pushed through.
Because my segue is from Raw to Medici, also by Rainer Knizia, published in 1995. And they do share some similarities, despite the fact that Raw is almost iconoclastic in its approach to auctions. Medici, in many ways, is far more traditional, but nonetheless feels an awful lot like Raw. It's traditional in the sense that you are bidding money, and money is victory points at the end of the game, and you can bid whatever you want. You're not obliged to bid a fixed value as you are in Raw. So in that sense, it's much more open, and I would add, a little bit intimidating during the early rounds, because you don't know what things are worth. It's a little bit like Raw in the sense that what you're doing is you're building these bundles of goods. You're drawing cards from the top of the deck. You can, long story short, draw 1, 2, or 3 cards and then offer those up for auction. And every round, of which there are 3, you can win a total of 5 cards. So when a number of cards are coming up, you're not just spending some of your points to buy them. You're also committing some of your overall capacity, because max you're going to win 15 cards. So when you buy a card in Medici, you know you are giving up a tremendous opportunity. At the end of every round, you compete in 2 different categories. One of them is just the sheer value of all the cards you have. I've got a 3, a 4, and 2 5s, okay, versus everybody else. And the specific suit of what all the cards are let you move up tracks, and whoever's the highest of those tracks, whoever has won the most swords will get points. And if you've won so many swords, you'll get bonus points on top. And so you're constantly trading off. It's like, ooh, I do like swords, but that's a 1 sword. I don't even know if that could cut cheese, let alone anything else. So I don't know if I want to buy that. Trade-offs abound. Marvelously simple. The reason why Medici is even more flexible than Raw is it goes up to 6, and it scales real well. I argue that Raw scales real well at 2, 3, 4, or 5. Even at 2 players, Raw works really well. The trick is, though, that Raw feels very different at different player counts. With 3, for example, in Raw, you have 4 sons as opposed to 3. 4 feels very different, and 5 feels extremely different because you have so much less control over the board state, but nonetheless, I still think you could make a go of it. You just have to accept that you have to live in that chaos. Medici, on the other hand, is a little bit more staged, a little bit more stated, but it still has that aspect of, I've won my 5 cards for the round, I'm out. I'm not participating for the rest of this round, and knowing when to go out is a huge burden. But, again, there's that tremendous difficulty for new players of knowing what something is worth. So, for example, in the very first auction of the game, I took the first turn, I flipped over 2 cards, said, okay, I bid last, that's the benefit of being the auctioneer, again, like Raw. First bid out from Huey was 10. I'm like, okay, so Huey, I'm not going to tell you how to live your life. And I'm not going to tell you that's a bad bid. But let's go over the scoring once again and what you might possibly win out of any given round. And he thought about it, you're right. And then he came back with 4. So, well, look, because again, your bid is points. This isn't just a question of being poor for future rounds. This is your victory points that you're spending in order to win these cards. And so sometimes you have to be exercise a little bit of guidance. I'm no Medici expert. I'm certainly not in a position to start telling people what good opening bids are like. But I can tell you that those cards were not worth 10. So I felt comfortable to sort of backing up and going over the scoring condition. But anyway.
I love those kind of opening bids, much like Skull. Where you really just, it's that sweet opening bid. And Skyrise has the same sort of thing. If there's a way to like block off the map or a certain tile where you need, just putting out that right building that will just ward people away and just let you take that because they have no idea why you want to win that so badly.
Well, in the context of Medici, you don't quite get that because it's a once around auction in terms of currency. And it's really hard, especially in a 6-player game, if you're the second or third bidder, to bid so high that it is worth it for you, but prevents the last player from upping you by 1.
Yeah.
It's tough. It happens a couple of times, and there's that dynamic absolutely materializes, but it's really hard. It's a little easier in the context of Skull, especially given that the bidding is so coarse, right? The coarser the bidding is in Skull, like the difference between a 3-bid and a 4-bid is huge.
Yes.
In Medici, it is not. And so it's a little bit more difficult to do. That, I think, for what it's worth, is one of the big knocks against Medici. It's pretty hard for the non-auctioneer to be able to lock in a bid, unless you're in a position where that lot is just useless to the auctioneer, but it's only of use to you. But in that case, you don't really need to bid that high. Anyway, Medici is brilliant. It is one of the best Knizia auction games, and indeed, most of the best auction games are by Knizia.
I was waiting to say this.
I think we can say, because...
There is an argument to say, like, Beowulf is, oh my god,
yeah,
one of the greatest.
Absolutely.
And I think there's an argument to be made that Tigris and Euphrates is a bidding game.
So I am sympathetic to the overall argument that all games are fundamentally auction games. But I think that of Knizia's games, Tigris and Euphrates is one of the least auction games that he's done. I kind of see where you're getting at. But when I think of his absolute all-time best auction games, I do think of Raw. I don't think of Tigris and Euphrates. I think of Beowulf. I think of Blue Moon. Those are the ones that I think of the all-time best.
I would never say it was an auction game.
Sure.
But you can make a convincing argument that it
fair enough.
Yes.
Medici, though, is simpler in rules, scales better, and tends to be very portable, even by the standards of Raw. There have been a bunch of different editions of Medici. Most of the recent ones have been admirably minimalist. And so I'm very glad to have a copy of Medici, and I was very pleased to get it back to the table. That is Medici by Rainer Knizia, published all the way back in 1995. And that's back before Rainer Knizia was Rainer Knizia. Back then, he was just Rainer Knizia.
Mark, we broke a rule, but it was worth it. Usually we don't play a game when there's a pending expansion.
That's not a rule. That's just weird neurosis we have. It is.
But Stroganoff we brought back to the table. And there was some debate. I am on one side.
Okay.
That I feel that we at least played one of the games correctly in the past.
Yes. So, it appears that my recollection, I was the one explaining the game, one of my recalled rules was wrong. And so the session that we played most recently, we absolutely played incorrectly. We just decided to stick with the rules misinterpretation. For the sake of consistency, we had already done a fair bit. Walker maintains, correct me if I'm wrong, that this mistake that we've made has reoccurred, but does not constitute the entirety of our experience of playing Strogoth.
That I'm not sure.
Oh, you don't know.
I don't know if we played it incorrectly before, but I'm almost positive we played it correctly before.
Whereas,
not every time before.
Whereas I am reasonably confident we've made this mistake in the past, and I am not sure if we've ever played it correctly. What is at issue is as follows. Strogonoff is a game about basically depopulating the Siberian wilderness of small furry animals. And there are some actions that care very deeply about what kind of animal you're using as currency and some actions that don't. And as far as purchasing new land tiles, which is A, but not necessarily the only significant source of points, the actual rules as written are that everything you use to buy them has to be the quote-unquote matching type of animal. So if it's in a certain region, they might only accept bunnies as payment. I'm exaggerating now the theme. They might only accept wolverines in a different region or stags in the other region. I remember very distinctly playing several instances, possibly leading up to our review, so this is very much an editorial correction, where you could pay with any kind of fur, because it was already expensive. You had to pay 2 furs plus 1 extra fur for every other fur that was on the tile, whereas the actual rules are they have to be very specific, which makes things very restrictive. I do not remember playing that way. I might have, but I don't remember.
I think we played it correctly at least once because I remember those animals actually mattering, which in the game we just played, they really didn't.
I disagree.
There was one action that allowed you to take another minor action. Like you did several actions on your turn. Playing an animal of the same area allowed you to do one more minor or major action. Like when I say major action, not that major.
Right.
And that was pretty well the extent of the limitation. And I remember it being much more constrictive. And I remember collecting many of a certain animal for reasons. So I really feel as though we did play it at least once correctly, if not every time.
So I went back to our original review of Strogonoff. So this is a design by Andreas Stetting. He's a game designer who's done a number of games that we either thoroughly enjoy, specifically Hansa Teutonica, or both of us to varying degrees enjoy, like Gugong. And I think Strogonoff is, for my taste, it's its second best design after Hansa Teutonica. I went back and I checked the review. And unfortunately, we don't disambiguate which rules we were playing with in the context of that discussion. For what it's worth, I think the game works perfectly fine. I'm not going to be one of those guys who plays a game wrong and says, I like my way better. I don't have an opinion because, again, I don't remember playing it the other way. I will assert that I do not think that the scoring with the rules mistake is facially imbalanced or obviously problematic. That is what I am comfortable asserting. As to how it feels the other way, as I say, I don't remember.
Agreed. And we'll find out because when we play it with the expansion, that is due it very soon, we will play it the correct way and we will get back to you.
Absolutely. I forgot how lovely Strogonoff is. It's really just, it's a beautiful pastoral landscape where you go and you just murder all kinds of small little creatures. Sometimes you kill a bear and you tell some stories about it. And that's the central currency of the game, not bears. Small furry creatures or large furry creatures in the case of bears. Sometimes a tiger shows up. Mostly it's smaller ones.
Nature's gotta pay.
It's a pseudo rondel, but really just going one direction and then resetting. And there's a tension between what you want to do and where you want to do it. I thoroughly enjoy Strogonoff. I think it's really well done. And apparently, the scoring is sufficiently robust that it can survive being mangled. So there you go.
We're not blind to the Cossacks and what they did. And the fact that you are Cossacks in this game, be aware.
Yes. Got to play Blitzkrieg World War II in 20 minutes. This is a review copy we got from the publisher. This is the Paolo Mori two-player version of Dogs of War. And I got to show this to a big Dogs of War fan. And I really enjoy what Blitzkrieg does with that central formula. So Dogs of War, as you may recall, is a worker placement game where effectively there are these three houses battling along a couple of tracks. And you can place a worker somewhere either because you really want the benefit of that space or because you really want to influence the war in one side's favor, or both. And ideally, if you're playing well, probably both more often than not. In the context of Blitzkrieg World War II in 20 minutes, the tracks are not abstracted away to some stock mechanism as they are in Dogs of War, which is still really cool. But instead here, they're just straightforward. You are winning or you are losing various points. But the way that it really gets its tension, though, is you're fighting on a whole bunch of different fronts simultaneously, and you cannot afford to completely ignore any of them. It's okay to lose. You're going to have to lose some of the fights. But if you give up on any of the fronts, then that's just a point bananza. bonanza for the opponent. And it's really hard to tear yourself away from the front where you're doing really, really well and to try to close it out on your terms just to hold up a lost cause somewhere else just so you don't get swamped. And deciding where to go and when is really the central tension of Blitzkrieg. I wouldn't say it's 20 minutes. It's still pretty quick. And I really enjoy what it does with the formula, and I think it's a good game on its own terms. We played with the normal map. There's also a Nippon expansion where you play the Pacific Theater. I don't like that map as much. It doesn't have as much of the same evolution of the fronts, because once a front is resolved in the Japan expansion map, it's just done. You move on to another front. And so you don't have the same kind of overarching tension. You're just pinging off to different new tracks.
But it has Godzilla.
But it does have Godzilla. I will grant you that that is a non-trivial inducement towards the Japanese map, but I prefer the core map. Blitzkrieg World War II in 20 minutes is a really delightful design. It is exceptionally well done by an exceptionally talented designer. Paolo Mori, PSC Games. If you enjoy Dogs of War, give it a shot. And if you don't enjoy Dogs of War, what is wrong with you?
Dr. Stallone asked for Radlands, so Dr. Stallone will get Radlands. This is designed by Daniel Pichnik and put out by Roxley Games. And this, what this is a post-apocalyptic two-player card battler that's played very quickly. You have six bases, you pick three of them, you put them out, and then you can make this grid of nine cards, three by three. The bottom three are your bases that you start with, then two rows of warriors, I guess you could say, that you can put out in front to protect them. And you're using water to spend to put them out. It has very limited card draw. It has interesting raid mechanics. I enjoy lots of things about it. It's very much a reactionary game where someone puts out something that can hurt you, and then you dedicate your whole turn to trying to get rid of that thing because it's going to hurt you very badly.
And you played by some of the new rules, correct?
That's correct. They're going to have a new expansion out. They've already put out like the 1.5 rules or the 2.0 rules, whatever they want to call them.
Numbers are made up.
Exactly. The cards cannot heal themselves, and you have the option of removing, like, if you fill that grid, then you cannot play any more cards. And they've added something where you're allowed to remove a card from your grid if you wish.
I'm very much interested in revisiting Radlands with those rules, because I remember very distinctly in the couple times that I played Radlands, it feeling like a grindy, attritional, unpleasant battler, partially by virtue of the fact that cards would show up and just heal themselves, because it's an obvious thing to do.
It's true. There is built into the original sort of this raid mechanism. You always have this raid available, and there's no way to stop it once it starts advancing, and it slowly will damage all the bases. And so that is sort of a timer in a way. But I enjoy it. There's ways to just play cards on your turn just for the symbols in the corner. There's ways to spend water, draw more cards. There's, you know, damaged bases still have their ability, whereas damaged warriors do not. Lots of interesting things going on in Radlands. Can't wait for the expansion and have yet to have a bad game.
Got to play Root. And one of the striking things about Root this time was we decided to do a configuration that I'd never played before and was always curious about and vaguely nervous about. And that is two Vagabonds. So we played with Lord of the Hundreds, which is one of the new factions, two Vagabonds, and the Eerie Dynasty. And so two very militaristic factions and two murder hobos that just wandered around giving out gifts and or battles indiscriminately. And I played as a vagabond that was basically a card draw machine. And so I was a wandering up to factions, becoming their friends and using them like point piñatas.
And no choice of their own.
Yes. Like, hello, friend. I have come to give you a gift. I don't want your gift. Here, have this card. I don't want your card. It's a lovely card. Give it. I don't want it. Take it away. Here it is. 2 points for me, please. Over and over again.
It's like this hide a bed. Here's this couch that can turn a bed. I don't want it. And then it's on your front lawn. It's like, yeah, but I... And it's too late.
Root has two key design defects as far as I'm concerned. And these are things that make me love Root less, but not to the extent that I wouldn't want to play Root all the time. One of them is there's a start player advantage. And the second thing is that there's no built-in incentive to attack the Vagabond other than to prevent the Vagabond from winning. This works better when there are factions that have the ability to generate battles at little cost themselves. So, for example, say you're playing as the Marquise de Cat. If you need to stop me as a Vagabond from winning, you need to spend a third of your turn to do it, to start a fight, to stop me, to set me back. And you're not going to earn any points from If you spend a third of your turn to stop somebody else from winning, you're probably in a position to score some points at it. Meanwhile, if you look at some of the other newer factions, like, for example, the Lord of Hundreds, the Lord of Hundreds generates more fights than they tend to use. That is ideal for a situation with the Vagabond. So this is one of those instances where I think some of the new factions have been designed with some idea in mind of helping the meta evolve in a positive way. So I very much approve of that. And it was the case that in this instance, it didn't quite manifest properly. The Lord of Hundreds was never quite willing to engage the necessary military force to stop the Vagabonds from their point engines. But that was just more a question of player choice and getting blinkered and just wanting to fight the Eerie Dynasty the entire time, which I completely understand. Root is marvelous. It was our game of the year 2018. I regret this not at all, even with the caveats listed above. I love all the expansions. I love all the cutesy animal drawings of Kyle Farren. Wonderful job, Root.
Many games of Paku Paku were played, and it's always great. Saying it only because to show you that we will play Paku Paku to the very end. It has everything. There's Paku Injustice. There's Paku Freedom. There's
anything can be Paku.
Exactly. Paku all is all. Paku. This is designed by Antoine Boza and published by Ravensburger.
I remain consistently impressed that despite the fact that it is a very silly, real-time dice-rolling dexterity game, it doesn't have the kinds of ambiguities you get in a lot of other games. What constitutes a toppling tower? What constitutes a die in front of somebody as opposed to not in front of somebody? You know, frequently you have these discussions. Paku Paku? No, it's always clear. It's great.
And I've yet to see someone that bounced off it. Not to say
was that a pun?
Not to say it doesn't happen.
Sure.
But I've yet to see it.
Got to play Project Elite again. I did this partially despite Walker because playing Project
without
Elite
without me. Yeah, without I was you. Sick and dying. And to rub it in, they played Project Elite.
On your bed, actually, next to you. It was very cruel. So here's the thing I just want to stress about Project Elite. Project Elite is a great formula. Again, we like real-time dice rolling. We like cooperative games. I'm less big on Project Elite than Walker is, in part because I don't think the decision-making is particularly well done. You know, it's reasonably straightforward what it is you want to do. You still get to play with some toys and roll out some dice. That's fun. I just want to stress something. Most Eurogamers especially have blind spots with respect to where luck can manifest in a game, and they look at a game like Project Elite, and they say, oh, well, you know, the dice results. Dice results ain't nothing in Project Elite compared to how the cards clump. Because whether or not a game in Project Elite is going to be exceptionally difficult and a slog or a cakewalk is almost entirely going to be driven by how the cards distribute themselves. So case in point, we had a cakewalk precisely because the cards, the spawn cards, just spaced themselves out really nicely. We didn't have a round where multiple cards, three or more, all triggered at the same spawn point, causing a concatenating wave of enemy advancements all at once. They were almost perfectly dispersed. If I had to stack the deck, I don't know that I could have done a better job. Similarly, every round in Project Elite, you pull two boss cards from the deck. The deck consists of 12 all-clear cards and 8 bosses. That means that you could have, by the end of round 3, 6 bosses on the board or 0. We had 0. So, that's just an example. Look, dice results matter, but if you're rolling lots of dice, they're probably going to even out, even in a game like Project Elite. Card results, though, oh man, they can destroy you. Project Elite is fun, but not, I think, top tier, in part because of these issues and in part because of the quality of decision-making being relatively shallow. I just wanted to stress, once again, don't sleep on the effect of card draws. You Dominion players that think your game is deterministic because it ain't got no dice, let me tell you. This was designed by Konstantinos Kikinis, Marco Portugal, and Satiros Tsantsilas. We played the Simon edition, which has more stuff, but is a little more wobbly than the Artipia Games edition. What can you do? It's also more widely available.
So was this Dr. Sloan's first time playing Project Elite?
It was.
And what did he think?
He enjoyed it.
Good. That makes me happy. Dr. Sloan and I also played Orleans, and most of the expansions were not played. That is to say, we played with all the buildings, no plague and no intrigue, and we did play with the sort of the pick up and deliver aspect of it, because I think it's, you know, very light sort of module. It's like, deliver these goods to the city and you'll get some victory points, and you just sort of have them out on the board and you don't have to waste any time drawing them or anything. It's just, if you happen to be in the right city at the right time, then points for you. And it really made me remember how rough this is for new players, because these building decks that you can build during the game with all of the expansions are so huge, and you have no idea what, you know, if any of them are any good. I enjoy them because I buy different ones every time, because it will force you to try different strategies and stuff and do things in a different way. Orleans is a bag builder.
You have all these base actions to start with. You draw some tokens out of a bag, and then you sort of plunk them into the different actions, because it requires a white villager and a sailor and a warrior, and that lets you travel on the river, and you can build, you know, outposts. There's this whole map thing, and then there's, you know, building your bag. Lots of different things. Enjoyed by both. Played anytime.
And now, a brief break while we pay some bills.
Most tax pros leave a message.
It's Jane. I'm moving on to a TurboTax expert who beat your price. Adam Devine, tell him how I feel.
Hey, tax pro, she's been thinking twice. Best believe TurboTax will beat your price. This is a tax break.
Switch to a TurboTax live expert and we'll beat what you paid your pro last tax season. Make the switch at TurboTax.com/beatyourprice. TurboTax full service only. Sign up by 12/20/2024 and file by 4/1/2025. Full details at TurboTax.com/beatyourprice.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And we're back with yet more games we played last week. Got to play Tower of Babel, another Rainer Knizia, excellent, excellent game. Very different from a lot of other games on the market. It's what I wanted Wolves to be, if you recall playing Wolves a few weeks ago, which had this cooperative, competitive sort of resource scarcity, offering things to people, not just to help them, but also because in offering them something, it helped you out. That's entirely how Tower of Babel works. You collectively are building these wonders for the sake of an area majority competition. The more cards you contribute means you have more pieces for the area majority scoring. But by the same token, sometimes you want offers to be rejected because every rejected offer gives you 1 point per card that's rejected. So there's this trade-off. Is this card more useful actually used, or do I want to try to make this a poison pill offer so that it gets rejected and I can keep using this card, possibly for area majority elsewhere? Splendid game, utterly unlike almost any other game I've played in its offering dynamic. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted Wolves to be good, and why I was so disappointed that it kind of manifested itself as a relatively straightforward push-your-luck exercise surrounded by a whole bunch of comparatively unsatisfying resource management. So Tower of Babel, designed by Rainer Knizia, originally published by Hans im Glück in 2005. Give it a shot if you have the chance.
So we had a sort of a dinner event, so I brought out some party games that I hadn't played my versions of. I had played Telestrations before, and I had picked up like this, you know, 12-player version, and it has been sitting on my shelf this whole time, and I thought this was a great time to bring it out. Unfortunately, all but like two of the 20 markers inside the box were
already zilch. Dried out.
But thankfully, Green Team Wins comes to the rescue.
Green Team Wins saves every day.
It's so true. So there
solid
were
the, Green Team move.
There were a marker. And Telestrations is a great game. Everyone has sort of a pad of dry erase sheets, and one says word. This is, you know, just being very basic here. It's not exactly what they say. One says the word, and then the next page is the picture, then word, then picture. And so you draw this card, and you roll the die, and everyone writes in their word. No one else can see it. And then you draw a picture of that word, and you flip the book, so when everyone passes to the left, all they can see is the picture. And then they write a word in the word on the word page that they think that you tried to draw, and then they pass it to the left, and then that person reads the new word and they draw a picture of what they think that is and then pass it to the left, and you go all the way around until your book makes it back to you, and then you tell the story of your book. Look, my story started out as ladder, and it turned into fire-breathing dragon through different crazy steps. Enjoyed by all. Designer uncredited. Artist also uncredited.
No, you're the artist, you see.
It's true. This is put out by the Op Games.
The OP.
The OP. And the other one was Beyond Balderdash. This is designed by Laura Robinson and Paul Tone and put out by Canada Games Company. And I've heard good things about it, so I decided to pick up a game at our local thrift store. There are multiple ones there. You want to give it a try? I bet you if you go to your local store, there will be some stacked up. And it's just the lying game, which I really enjoy about it. It'll give you like a date, June 3rd, 1937. That's all you've got. Or a person's name or some letters, like an acronym, right? You decide, the main person decides, and then they read it out, and then everyone just sort of makes up a story based on that date or that acronym.
An ostensible explanation for what it is, yeah.
Like, it's much like the Liar's Club. And then the person who's that read it out, they write down on the same kind of sheet of paper what the actual answer is. And then they take all of the answers, they mix them up, and they read through them, just to go through the very important rules, reads them quickly so they don't mess up or pause during the silly ones.
Right.
Reads through them, and everyone votes on what they think is the right answer. You get some points if someone picks your answer. You get some points if you actually wrote the right answer, which seems odd. I should read the rules again, because the person that's reading the card writes down the actual answer. And if someone writes down the same answer, they read that twice? Wouldn't that, like, totally give away?
I don't know. It's weird. That's one of look, I played Balderdash once when I was a young child.
Yes.
And my recollection is only that somebody who knows the actual answer was in a strange position. And it led to weird situations.
Yeah, it definitely shows its date.
Right? But that's not the point, right? And I find that difficult. As a pedantic child who's trying to grow out of those pedantic impulses, it is strange to me to know the real answer and yet be encouraged not to give the real answer. Because, like, and that's not a hat. If you don't remember what the thing is, you try to bluff, of course, but there's never a reason, and that's not a hat, to bluff when you know the answer. So it's a strange set of impulses. I haven't played recently, but that's my recollection.
So it was enjoyed by all, especially me. Definitely shows its age. This, you know, writing out. I'm not sure how many people nowadays know how to write. but there it is. Beyond Balderdash.
I'm sure there's a Jackbox version.
Probably.
Yeah. Played a game of Quest. This is the derivative of The Resistance by Don Eskridge, designer of The Resistance, and published by Indie Boards and Cards. Pro tip, if you're going to play Quest, play by the Director's Cut rules. The rules as published in the original box were modified by the publisher in ways that lead to degenerate game states, so stay away from that. Here's the trick with Quest, though. I talk a lot about how The Resistance can be very tense, and some people don't like that, because in The Resistance, it's all a logic puzzle, there is stuff to be inferred, and people are going to be put on the spot to explain what's going on, their understanding of the game state, or why they voted the way they did, or who threw red and when, and some people really don't like that. They would rather their social deduction games be obscured by random chance, which is not my preferred way, or subject to a little bit less open discussion over everything, which I can completely respect. So slightly more towards the werewolf vein in that sense. And Quest is very much a little bit more towards werewolf in both that sense and in the sense that there's lots of special roles. You know, the default game of Quest, built in, there are special roles. There are a lot of optional ones, but the expectation is that you're going to mix some of those. So consequently, it's less tense, but it's consequently more complicated. The rules are more in-depth and more involved. And so there's this weird balance, and I think a lot of people are going to fall through the cracks and not want to play either of them. And that's what happened this time. We actually got to play Quest with the Wendigo. And the Wendigo, despite being a very capable hobbyist gamer, found the permutation of different roles and the alterations of the game state that entailed to be a little bit overwhelming. And consequently, he felt rather intimidated during the early rounds. And you don't want to make someone feel intimidated over the course of the game, especially in a highly social game like social deduction. He rallied, and it worked out, but nonetheless, it's a burden.
Especially when it can break, right? When you can be responsible 100%. For breaking a game.
Yes.
That is brutal.
That did not happen. Fortunately, we did have a very interesting game state. I distrusted Louis and the Wendigo because I thought that the Wendigo was covering for Louis. He was. But that's only because the Wendigo was wrong. Louis was trustworthy and had a role that forced him to present himself as untrustworthy when his loyalty was investigated. And so consequently, I correctly interpreted the tells, but that led me to a false impression of the game state, which I kind of appreciate. Again, an entirely different vibe from The Resistance. But if you want a little bit more, I guess, chaotic and slightly wackier, it's not really very wacky, but slightly wackier game, but you don't want to go all the way into, you know, the incredibly stage managed, but nonetheless extraordinarily chaotic mess that is Blood on the Clock Tower, then Quest might be for you. It's worth giving a shot. Now, that having been said, it's impossible to find on BoardGameGeek, because if you just enter Quest and hit enter, good luck.
Good luck.
You should search by the designer, Don Eskridge. I still prefer The Resistance, but The Resistance is one of my favorite games of all time, and it needs the right crew. But then again, so does Quest.
It is a great joy when Butterfly asks to play a game, and it was great for me because I have yet to get my copy of Calico onto the table. So we played Calico, enjoyed by her and I, designed by Kevin Russ, and put out by Flat Out Games. And it's much like in the Cascadia vein. You have an option of three different quilt patterns. And after you've placed one of your two, you draw one of the three and then it replenishes. And then you're placing these tiles on this giant quilt. You're trying to place them in a way that satisfies all these different sort of central tokens, like different numbers of patterns, of colors. And you can actually do it in a way that satisfies both colors and patterns. And that gets you bonus points. And I enjoyed this game because it was like the last tile I needed, Mark. I needed pink polka dots.
And guess what? Who doesn't?
What was drawn as the very last tile but pink polka dots? So I got to draw it. And then on my next turn, out came pink polka dots, which finished my 10 different tiles. So 10 different colors, 10 different patterns. And I don't care what the rest of this is.
Good for you, Walker.
And so, Calico, I love it. There's also like putting groups of colors together. There's also a bunch of like three different cats that you randomly draw at the beginning. And they have their own sort of rules that they want you to do on the quilt. And when you do it, you get these little cat tokens. You put them out on the board. So cats are now resting on your quilt. Everything about Calico is delightful. And Mark loves it.
I appreciate the design. I respect it a great deal. It makes me physically unwell. Literal headaches. Played Legacy of You a couple times. This is the solo design by Shem Phillips at Garfield Games. Garfield Games of the X-Profession of the Y Place Name series. And Legacy of You was held up as, hey, if you don't like the rest of Shem Phillips' designs, try Legacy of You. It was very enjoyable for the first couple of plays. And I reported as such, and sure enough, a listener showed up on the Patreon-exclusive Discord saying, I'd be curious to see how you feel about it after another few games. I felt it peter out, and the diminishing return set in real hard. And I can attest that this listener was 100% correct. It is an interesting optimization resource puzzle that plays out the exact same way. And so the same rhythm happens, the same dynamic, the same kind of inflection points, the same kind of pressures. The only difference is just going to be quibbling around the margins about which resource you might need at any given time. And frankly, whether I need the white meeple or an extra piece of brick does not constitute an engaging game experience or a particularly reactive form of AI. These are the kinds of pressures that need to be provided either by another group of players in the context of a competitive game, or in the case of a solo game, of a sufficient variety of things to do and or a variety of kind of pressures to be faced with. And so I really did feel like my subsequent plays were identical to the prior ones. There's a ostensibly some of the mitigation of this is that there's a book of narrative where various paragraphs get read, but you're building a dam. It's a story about building a dam, and sometimes what happens is a dam fails, or you need more food for your workers, or a dam fails, or you need more food for your workers, and it's fine. It does the job, but it's not going to keep me coming back and back, especially when the gameplay is proving to be sufficiently repetitive. So after playing about 2.5 games that felt identical to each other, once I figured out the rhythm of how to do well in Legacy of You, I am not apt to go back. So if you have the chance to try it a couple times, sure, why not? But I don't think it has much staying power past that. Also, I got to play BattleCon, specifically BattleCon Unleashed. BattleCon is another two-player game that I absolutely adore that I've had bad luck introducing to people. Now, part of this is my fault. BattleCon is a two-player card battler that is an elaborated rock, paper, scissors that is vaguely evocative of two-player fighting games with loads of special rules, asymmetry, and lots of counters. Almost everything has a counter. There's a counter to this. I'm not at range. Oh, I stunned you before you actually got to act. And this leads to a lot of excellent, intense decision-making about how to counter your opponent's counters and this, that, and the other. The problem is...
Or it might lead to massive frustration.
That's part of the reason why I'm really bad at introducing it. And also because a lot of the characters that I tend to gravitate toward do focus on denial and zoning and a variety of other things, very much like how I play actual fighting games. But I was conscious of this time. I'm like, all right, Mark, this isn't so much your opportunity after years of not playing BattleCon to do all the BattleCon goodness that you want to do and to play the planeswalkers that just engage in ridiculous denial tactics. Be conscious of the fact that you are trying to cultivate someone who might want to play this again if you play your cards right, no pun intended. And so what we did was we had a matchup of two brawlers whose overall attitude towards fighting is hit me as hard as you can, bro, and I'll hit you as hard as I can.
Slapping contest.
More or less. Now, the trick is that even at its simplest, BattleCon lets you do lots of cool stuff, because every character has their unique styles and their unique bases and their unique ways of doing things and their special powers, but both of these characters that we picked were focused around standing right in front of the other player and just get punching and getting punched as hard as possible. And this is, I think, a great way to introduce BattleCon, because there's always going to be enough differentiation. I don't think it's possible to play a game of BattleCon at all and walk away saying, ah, the characters didn't have any personality, it all felt samey. So you might as well pick something that's really simple and going to lead to a minimum of frustration. I played as Cesare Grist, and my opponent played as Lord Eustace, who, by the way, parenthetically for those not familiar, is a skeleton with ice powers wearing a top hat. Again, as I said, you don't walk away from a game with BattleCon saying not enough personality.
I was going to say that was inferred by his name, wasn't it?
Exactly. So Lord Eustace bulks up with his ice armor, says, hit me as hard as you can. Cesare Grist loads up with his stun protection and says, hit me as hard as you can. And there you go. I think it was a great intro set. I don't know why they don't print this as a recommended intro matchup for people that are being introduced to BattleCon. So I think I was more successful introducing BattleCon to this player than I have been in a great long time, which is wonderful. I love BattleCon, but I've had a bit of difficulty finding opponents, which, again, I understand. The frustration tolerance against certain kinds of matchups and certain kinds of plays is very, very real. There is the simpler version, which is called BattleCon Exceed, which has a little bit more traditional hand management in the sense that you're drawing blindly off the top of a deck. But that, again, that loss of control, that drawing randomly from a deck is one of the reasons why I like Exceed less, frankly. But I see the virtue in both game systems. But I was very, very pleased to return to BattleCon Unleashed, which was the most recent set of BattleCon. I've got to... all of BattleCon, which, given how often I play it, is vastly more BattleCon than I need, but this was BattleCon Unleashed.
We also got to play Team 3 today, and this is a fantastic dexterity game.
Is it?
Is it
a dexterity game? That's my question.
It is, for the builder, I think.
Okay.
So, before we go any further, right, let's talk about Team 3. One person is the person that has, sort of like UGTech, where, you know, one person has the plan, and they're beating the other person over the head.
Okay, no. There are no inflatable clubs. There is no beating at all.
It's true.
In Team 3.
So one person has the building. They are not allowed to speak. And so they are using hand gestures and other things, other ways to tell another person.
Mostly facial expressions of frustration.
Of pain and suffering.
Yes.
On how to tell the third person, who has their eyes closed, how to build a structure. So it's relating hand gestures to the person speaking, not that piece, turn it, no, spin it, no.
Yep.
And then I think the dexterity comes into once you've placed some pieces and now you're reaching for other pieces, knowing where that structure is.
That's fair.
And knowing and remembering how it's laid out and placing it in a way that's going to stay together once you've let go. I think there is some dexterity to it. Every time I played it, I do enjoy it. I don't think it works great at 6, which is what we played it at. It really is just like 2-3 player games.
Yeah.
You know, they say rotate fair. Around, but I think the way we played it was the best for what we did. We just played, you know, one round.
One group of three, and then you swap out to the other group of
and
three.
And then the other three, you know, pointed rather and than clockwise while the other ones were playing.
Yes.
I will play Team 3 anytime.
It's a great companion or sort of complementary game to Jenga Maker. Jenga Maker is very limited in player count. You play it with 4 or 6 players, really only 4, pretty much. And the pieces and what you build in Jenga Maker are more interesting, but Team 3 is more flexible and leads to slightly more chaos, and thus is enjoyable from that perspective. It also has some, we're just going to call them Gibbons. They say monkeys, but I'm just going to call them Gibbons. Gibbons representation all the way. I found it hilarious every time Dewey kept telling you who had their eyes closed, didn't pick up, no, not the pink one, pick up the black one. It made me laugh every time. I don't know why he thought it would work.
It did work, because I knew what the black shape was.
Are you sure?
Yes.
I think you're making things up. Nope. I think you're telling stories. Those are the games we played last week, and now on to the news and why it doesn't matter. We love Tapple. Tapple is great. The only problem I have with Tapple sometimes is due to my irrational exuberance. I sometimes tapple the Tapple too hard, and then sometimes I won't tapple properly. But Tapple is a great word association game with a lovely gimmick of a big dial in the middle. You hit a plunger and say, you know, R for raccoon, because the category's animal. We love Tapple. Now there's going to be Tapple After Dark with, like, adult categories? No. My enthusiasm for Tapple has found its limit, and now I must Tapple out.
Real news. My mind's the news of the future, because this is a week ahead.
So in the future, Mark, I was playing on my AR/VR hover table.
Yep.
And then one of the stabilizers gave out.
Oh, I hate it when that happens.
And then it crashed. The one side crashed to the ground, and the two pieces that were actual physical pieces flew off, and we had no idea how to reset the game state. I hate when that happens.
Did it damage the capacitor, too?
Oh, slightly. But the combobulator held it together.
Race for the Galaxy, which is my favorite tableau builder, is going to get a roll-and-right. Now, normally, I would not be excited about this, because everything is getting a roll-and-right version, and I'm not typically such a huge fan of them. But there are two exceptions. If Knizia says he's doing a roll and write, I will be cautiously optimistic. Tom Lehman is doing a roll and write, and Tom Lehman's approach to roll and write apparently is, I don't want to make it feel like any other roll and write. So, time will tell. I'm cautiously optimistic again, I guess. Tom Lehman's design work tends to be very impressive, even in sometimes in games like Jump Drive that I don't feel quite cohere. But I think that Race for the Galaxy roll and write is something to look out for.
So there's this fantastic new dungeon crawling game on crowdfunding. It has all these like intense miniatures, and you can play in so many different modes. There's a solo version, competitive, cooperative.
Yep.
And there's so many modules, and the more people that crowdfund it, it has all these like different stages where you get more stuff. It's going to be great. I can't wait. You think you want a dungeon crawler? Wait till this thing comes out. Man, it does everything. Player boards, deck building, worker placement, area control on the map. You fight monsters. You go into dungeons. Oh, man.
See, the thing is, I know you're joking, but the problem is, if you had just included dexterity for combat resolution, you know we would have pledged.
Oh, that's coming soon.
I know. We actually did pledge for that. Finally, for me, I would once again like to plug my new podcast project, All My Best Friends Are Digital, which is about video games and the stories they tell. This is with my friend Caitlin Bailey. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're at all interested, please do give us a listen.
And on the same note...
What's that online resume thing?
LinkedIn.
I'm on LinkedIn. So if anyone needs a podcast co-host...
I would never leave you, Walker. You have official legal custody of the Gibbons. Or is it the other way around? I never remember. And with that, thank you very much for joining us. That's it for this week for So Very Wrong About Games. We really appreciate your deciding to having to spend the time with us. We hope to see you again soon. Take care of yourself and take care of your hobby.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Bickman. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.
Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/prenatal.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.